WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Noah Feldman, is currently advising the Iraqi Governing Council on the creation of a new constitution. He spent part of the spring and summer in Baghdad working with the U.S. Office for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, advising on issues pertaining to the structure of government, including the constitutional process. Feldman is a professor at the NYU School of Law, where he co-directs the Center on Law and Security. His new book, After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy, poses the question, can democracy be made to flourish in the lands where Islam prevails? He argues that it can. I asked him why he believes that, at a time when many people fear that an Islamic government will lean toward fundamentalist extremism and become more of a theocracy than a democracy.
The reason is that Muslims themselves say so. An increasingly large number of Muslims, and in Iraq, just to give one example, this group of Muslims are probably the majority, say openly that they think that their Islamic values are compatible with democracy, that they interpret Islam in such a way as to demand the rule of law, as to demand equality for all people, men and women, Muslims and non-Muslims, and to demand elections. So if enough Muslims say that this is their commitment and belief, then I believe that there will be a version of Islam that will emerge as compatible with democracy. It just turns entirely on Muslims themselves.
Let me give you an example of the kind of thing I think a lot of people are worried about in terms of an Islamic democracy. There's an article this week in the New York Times about how now that the Iraqi courts have virtually disappeared, some young clerics are holding court, so to speak, and giving their opinions about how things should be handled. And in this article, it described a man who killed his mother because she had been sullying the family name by committing adultery since he was a boy, so he murdered her. And he thought that that was the just thing to do. And he went to the cleric, basically, you know, in the hopes that the cleric would tell him that he did the right thing. And these clerics apparently have given religious approval to certain killings, like killing members of the Ba'athist party, the Ba'athist government, the government of Saddam Hussein. What do you think of this? Did you read the article, and what did you think of these clerics and what that has to say about the possibilities of Islamic democracy in Iraq?
I did read the article, and one of the key elements of the article is that according to the leadership of the Muslim community in Iraq, of the Shi'i community, the people running this so-called court are unauthorized, young, essentially graduate students who are clearly relatively radical, associated with one of the more radical factions, and whose views don't actually reflect traditional Islamic law, something that was made very clear by the senior clerics when interviewed. So, for example, the idea that one could, of one's own accord, murder a family member who was suspected of adultery is absolutely out of accord with Islamic law. It's not in any way compatible with Islamic teaching. And the fact that the clerics, or the wannabe clerics, as it were, in the article agreed to this, as the article reported, is just a wonderful proof that they're not following Islamic law. Instead, they're acting like revolutionaries who are doing what they can in a kind of situation of vacuum with respect to the courts in Iraq. There are secular courts, but they're not yet working in an extensive way. And so these young bucks, as it were, are getting into the act by stepping up and offering rough justice, but they're not offering classical Islamic justice. So I think that for Islam and something like the rule of law to work together, what you need are properly constituted courts. And if a bunch of law students, no offense to law students, I love law students, I was one relatively recently myself, but if a bunch of law students got together and decided in a revolutionary moment here that they were just going to dole out the law, I don't think we would consider that to be a proof that democracy and our system were incompatible. We would just say that those folks don't know the law yet.
You know, for some people, when they think of Islamic justice, they think of stoning a woman to death for adultery or honor killings, killing a woman because she has sexually sullied the family reputation. Is that classic Islamic justice or is that extremism?
Certainly, honor killings are not authorized by Islamic law. They are absolutely not authorized. to the extent that execution is permitted under classical Islamic law, it's only after a trial at which the standard of proof is extraordinarily high. Now, it's true that classical Islamic law, much like classical Jewish law, in theory prescribes some very drastic punishments for things like adultery. So you can find it on the books that a woman properly convicted of adultery, which means that responsible witnesses in full broad daylight saw the adulterous act in person, which if you can think about it is a relatively unusual set of circumstances, that in principle a capital punishment is prescribed. But in practice, such things are rarely, if ever, brought about under classical Islamic legal sources. There are one or two instances of this happening or something equivalent happening in Saudi Arabia, and I think those are terrible. It's really a shame that such a thing could happen. But operating within Islamic law, it's entirely possible to avoid ever executing a punishment like that. What we're seeing is a legal system that has the capacity to evolve in much the same way that Western legal systems have the capacity to evolve. And things that we regularly punished with the death penalty 100 or 200 or 300 years ago, we wouldn't imagine of imposing that sort of punishment for today. Islam has that same capacity to develop on its own.
Are you worried that in the vacuum that's being created now, in that period before a new constitution, before courts are reestablished, before a government is reestablished, are you worried that in this vacuum, courts like these extremist young clerics setting up are going to prosper, and that other forms of what you described as rough justice will come into being, and that they'll be maybe hard to dislodge?
It worries me a lot, because setting up a responsible justice system is the most important task, I think, of a government in making itself legitimate. If the citizens aren't going to your courts, but they're going to somebody else's courts, it's pretty hard to say that you're really the overall most important government in place. So I am concerned about it. On the other hand, there's a way to combat it too. And the way to combat it is to pour a lot of resources into getting the Iraqi courts reconstituted up and running. And the people whom I had the privilege of working with in Iraq who are working on these issues were on the right track. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they had a good plan in place to reconstitute the justice system. It's really simply a question of resources. And it's my view that we need to put a lot more resources than we have been putting into that task, exactly to avoid the problem that you describe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Noah Feldman. He's the author of the book After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy, and the book makes the case for Islamic democracy. He is also now advising the Iraqis on forming a new constitution. Can you give us an example of an interesting and telling disagreement among the Iraqis working on the new constitution about a fundamental principle that should or should not be in the constitution?
One crucial subject is federalism in the new constitution. There's broad agreement among almost all the Iraqis that I spoke to that the new Iraq has to be federal in some way. In other words, there has to be a region that corresponds roughly, or a series of regions that correspond roughly, to where most of the Kurds live in the northern part of the country. And there also need to be other regions, perhaps a central Baghdad region, perhaps a southern region, perhaps multiple regions broken up roughly according to the governorates. Where the Iraqis disagree, though, pretty deeply, is about how much autonomy these individual regions ought to have. The Kurds would like a maximum amount of autonomy. They've got a history of being oppressed by the central government. They have a different language, or rather different languages. They have a culture that's distinctive in many ways. They want as much independence as they can possibly get. And the rest of the country is concerned that there's a danger that if a Kurdistan or a Kurdish region has too much independence, that could lead to the possibility of it seceding and breaking the country apart, which is a result that nobody in Iraq really wants very much. So the debate about how much federalism there should be is actually going to be a very, very serious and extensive debate. Even though it sounds as if all sides roughly agree on federalism, that actually doesn't tell you very much. There needs to be a lot of discussion about who's going to rule what and from where.
One of the fundamental principles of America's democracy is the separation of church and state. In Iraq, is it likely is the Constitution not likely to say anything about the separation of church and state? Is it likely to be an Islamic democracy that doesn't have that clear line that America has tried to uphold?
I say in my book, After Jihad, that in America we have trouble imagining a democracy without the separation of church and state, but that in most Muslim countries, and Iraq is one in this respect, it's just about impossible to imagine a true democracy that had an absolute separation of church and state. The reason for that is that the vast majority of people in Iraq, for example, would like Islam to play at least some symbolic or value-providing role in their government, which doesn't mean that the country will be governed by Islamic law, because I don't think that will be the case. What it means is that the constitution will either acknowledge Islam as the religion of 95% or perhaps a little bit more of all Iraqis, or it will acknowledge that the values of Islam matter to the Iraqi people. And it will also do so alongside a commitment to democracy, a commitment to equality, and a commitment to basic liberties. So what we'll have is a state that is both democratic and, in some sense, Islamic. You know, the phrase Islamic State conjures up in people's minds a picture of Iran, of a government by mullahs. And that's not going to happen in Iraq. It shouldn't happen in Iraq, and I'm confident that it will not. But a state can be Islamic in other ways, too. It can be Islamic in the sense that Islamic values affect people's decisions, in the sense that when legislation is passed, people think about Islamic values. When there are public events, the prayers that, let's say, consecrate those events take place in Arabic or are Muslim prayers. And all of those things can happen alongside a robust democracy, in my view, and increasingly in the view of many Iraqis, too.
Before you started directly advising the Iraqis, you were working with the Bush administration in consulting on the formation of an Iraqi constitution. Historically, do you think that the United States has worked on behalf of democracy in the Islamic world and the Arab world?
Absolutely not. Our history is one of, it's a shameful history, really, of, for the most part, supporting dictators because we were concerned to keep the oil flowing, and we thought that stability was the key to keeping the oil flowing, and we thought that the dictators were in a position to keep that process going. Now, there may have been some justification for this approach, maybe during the Cold War, when there was a concern that some of the countries of the region might become Soviet allies, might become communist or socialist, and as indeed some did, if they weren't kept in line by a heavy-handed dictator. So perhaps then there was some justification for this. But there really isn't any now that the Cold War is over. And what's more, after September 11th, we can no longer tell ourselves that having autocrats on our side in the region ensures that our interests are protected, because one of the motivations of bin Laden and of the Al-Qaeda terrorists was to attack us because of our support of regimes in the region, like the Saudi government. So given that it's no longer an approach that keeps us safe, given that supporting dictators is no longer an approach that can be justified by some broader purposes of the state, I think it's an approach that's got to change.
Do you think the Bush administration thinks that way too? And do you think the Bush administration, and that the president himself, would agree with you in your analysis that we have been on the wrong side historically, that we haven't supported democracy, we've supported the autocrats?
It's difficult for presidents, any president of any party, to announce that past U.S. policy has been wrongheaded, and I'm guessing that it's especially difficult to do that if one's own father was part of that policy. On the other hand, people vote with their feet, and so do countries sometimes. And by our intervention in Iraq, we've certainly signaled that we're ready for things to change very significantly. Certainly, the invasion of Iraq, or the liberation, if you prefer to call it that, marks a fundamental change in our approach to the region and our public commitment to creating democracy there, a commitment which everything that I saw suggests is actually shared, is not some public consumption doctrine that, in fact, is secretly being undermined. Suggest that we really are interested in changing our policies in the region. Now, we haven't changed our policies everywhere. There are still plenty of autocratic governments that are being propped and up and shored up by us. But by creating a democracy in the region, or helping create a democracy in the region, which is our stated policy at this point, we're going to send shockwaves through the governments of the autocratic Arab rulers. There's no question about that. When the Iraqi Constitutional Convention is broadcast live in Arabic on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and Abu Dhabi TV, it's going to be watched in Cairo. It's going to be watched in Damascus. It's going to be watched in Riyadh and Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And that's going to have a big, big effect on the region. And believe me, the governments of the region know that perfectly well.
My guest is Noah Feldman. He's consulting with the Iraqi Governing Council on the creation of a new constitution. His new book is called After Jihad. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Feldman is my guest. He's the author of the book After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy. He's now consulting with the Iraqis on writing a new constitution. Noah Feldman, let me point out here that you are Jewish and that you grew up in an Orthodox family. And, you know, there is a lot of anti-Semitism right now in the Islamic world and a lot of conspiracy theories about what the Jews are responsible for. What's it like for you, as somebody who is Jewish, to be consulting now on the formation of an Islamic democracy?
There are a lot of conspiracy theories around. You're absolutely right. And in the Arab press, one regularly sees anti-Semitic language and arguments that had become actually relatively more rare over the last decade or so. They're experiencing a resurgence now. It's a very troubling phenomenon. But as with many forms of prejudice, it's more abstract than particular. When I was in Iraq, speaking with Iraqis, everyone from, you know, ordinary people on the street to college students, lawyers, even a professor at the Islamic University in Baghdad, I didn't experience any anti-Semitism directed towards me. To the contrary, people were often sort of interested in a kind of, gee, never met one before way to find out that I was Jewish. And of course, these are not ordinary circumstances. I was there as part of a U.S. government operation that includes soldiers with guns. So it was not as if I was in any physical danger.
At what point does it usually come up that you're Jewish? Is it something that you bring up? Do they ask you about your religious background? Do they know enough to know that, like, Feldman, sounds like a Jewish name?
It's funny. In the Arab world, first names matter a lot more than last names. And the Arabic version of the name Noah is Nuh. And in Arabic, that name is generally a Christian name. It's generally Christian Arabs who have that name. So based on first name alone, I think very often people don't quite gather that I'm Jewish. So it's something that comes up in the course of conversation if the subject turns to religion. In the case of the professor at the Islamic University with whom I had a conversation, we were sort of talking about high-flown ideas of democracy and Islam and were they compatible, many of the subjects that you and I were just discussing. And about two-thirds of the way, he stopped and he turned and looked at me full on and he said to me, "Are you Christian?" And it was very clear that he expected a no for an answer. And for a second, I thought to myself, well, you know, what answer ought I to give under these conditions and circumstances? And then I said to him, "No, I'm Jewish." And he nodded his head sort of sagely and stroked his beard, and we went on with the conversation. He didn't offer a comment on it one way or the other. So that was how it came up in that context. One time it came up because I visited a traditional Jewish shrine site in Iraq in a town called Kifl, which is reputed to be the gravesite of the prophet Ezekiel. And this was a synagogue for well over 1,000 years. It's a very, very beautiful building. Now it's functioning as a mosque. And I was reading the Hebrew inscriptions, which are for the most part well-preserved in the building. And someone came over to me there, one of the local people, and he obviously knew that I was Jewish. And we had a lengthy conversation about the Jewish community of the town and what buildings they had built and which houses they had lived in. And he introduced me to one old man who was 90-some years old who could still recite poems that he said had been written by one of the Jewish inhabitants of the town. And there, people were actually remarkably welcoming. It's obviously not a typical town, but they had very, very warm memories of their Jewish residence. And when we asked the oldest living man in the town how he felt about the possibility of the Jews returning, he said, "Well, I'm 90-some years old. I can't read and I can't write, but it seems to me that a good person is a good person." And I was very struck by that answer, and the people in the crowd that had gathered around to listen to the words of this wise old man seemed pretty receptive to it.
Let's get back to consulting on the Iraqi constitution. Would you like to see in that constitution something that ensures equal rights and human rights for people who are not of the Islamic faith? For Jews, for instance, there had been a thriving Jewish population in Iraq. Most of the Jews fled because of discrimination and persecution.
The Iraqi constitution has to guarantee equal treatment before the law for all Iraqi citizens, regardless of faith and regardless of sex as well. That's hugely important.
That gets to the question, if it's like an Islamic democracy, if there isn't a separation of church and state, what is the place for people whose beliefs are different and whose religious law is different?
With respect to governing their own religious lives, people should be able to use their own religious faiths, and the Constitution should guarantee that. And Islam, in principle, should permit that, because the Quran itself says that there shall be no coercion in matters of religion, and people should be, in a state that's truly democratic and truly Islamic, free to practice their faiths as they choose and be free of discrimination on those points. Now, it's certainly true that if there's a debate about some point of the criminal law, let's say, in the Iraqi legislature, and some of the legislators think that some point derived from Islamic tradition with respect to, let's say, the standard of proof ought to be dominant. And if a Christian, let's say, because there are many Christians living in Iraq, now, there are perhaps 500,000 Christians living in Iraq, now got up in the legislature and said, well, you know, actually our legal tradition is different on this point, or I don't think that the Islamic point should prevail, should be fine for that legislature to say that, legislator to say that. When they vote, it may be that the fact that there are a small minority of people who are Christians, you know, you're talking about 500,000 people out of a country of 25 million, will mean that that view won't carry the day. But it needs to be possible for everyone to get their views out there and to speak freely. And similarly, it has to be guaranteed that everyone who lives and functions in Iraq is treated as a full Iraqi citizen. But Islam should not only permit but require that, as understood by many, many Muslims. And democracy, what's more, requires that. So remember that when I speak of an Islamic democracy, I don't mean that it's less democratic. I mean something that's fully and authentically and legitimately democratic, meaning that it guarantees equality of all persons, that it guarantees rights, and that it also is in some meaningful way something that reflects Islamic values at the same time.
Noah Feldman, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Noah Feldman is consulting with the Iraqi Governing Council on the creation of a new constitution. He's also the author of the book After Jihad, and he co-directs the Center for Law and Security at NYU. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.